everything went back to the banks, and the banks then started to teeter.
So ultimately, the party that is on the other side of this bet that Magnitar and others like them are doing are either the CDOs, the actual instruments, are taking the long part of it, or the banks themselves, which, you know, in the end, when it all explodes, the taxpayers have to bail out.
Because in the end, they really don't have the financial resources to pay off their bets, right? They're writing insurance that they're really not able to make good on.
Right? Yeah, well, there's this two-step process where Magnitar is entering this bet with the CDO, and kind of unbeknownst to everyone, the bank that's creating the CDO is buying most of it. And so the bank is really on the hook for it. And when the bank teeters, then taxpayers have to come in and bail it out. And so we were bailing out the banks that had made this bad bet with hedge funds like Magnitar.
Now, so how did Magnitar do? How did the hedge fund do? How did its managers do financially in all this?
They did spectacularly well. They were up 76% in 2006, their main fund. They made hundreds of millions of dollars on this.
But again, quantifying exactly how much they made is very hard to do because hedge funds are fairly opaque and they don't have to report great detail about their performance.
Okay. And now broaden the lens for us and tell us why we care about this. I mean, people make hundreds of millions and lose hundreds of millions on Wall Street. Why did what Magnitar was up to impact the economy as a whole?
Well, Magnitar created more than $40 billion worth of this stuff at a time when this business on Wall Street, I mean, really should have petered out in 2006. There was a bubble, a housing bubble in this country, and it was going to pop. And whether Magnitar was involved or not, that was going to happen. But the size of it, the scale of it, the incredible damage to the economy, in large degree was because it went on for several more years than it should have, and Wall Street really just inflated the heck out of it. So Magnitar had a big role in that.
And as late as last year and still up to today, you hear that the financial crisis was a 100-year flood, that no one had control over it, no one could foresee it. And in fact, what we wanted to show with our stories is that lots of bankers knew that things were in trouble, that the housing market was going down, and that demand was falling away for these securities, and they went on. They did it anyway. Some of them did it because they could bet against it. Some of them did it because they would make fees helping clients who were betting against it. Some of them did it just to sort of keep the machine going and making bonuses, huge bonuses in 2006 and 2007. 2007 was a record year for CDO production in the early part of the year, despite that there was almost no real demand for this.
I mean, the CDO market more than doubled from 2005 to 2006. It reached $226 billion. And just in the first quarter of 2007, Wall Street produced $70 billion of this stuff.
Now, I want to make sure we get Magnitar's side of this into the extent we can. And on your website, of course, you print Magnitar's written responses to you. Did you ever talk to any of the principals?
We had, extensive conversations with Magnitar and were very, very careful about trying to understand exactly what their point of view was. And we had a lot of written communication. We published all of that, including all of our written questions and their responses and then their letter that they published and then a subsequent letter that they sent to their investors. And I think you can summarize their argument like this: that they never had a view on the housing market. They say, we were not making a bet on whether the housing market was going to fail or succeed. We were just doing an arbitrage, a complex kind of investment where you buy one thing that you think is cheap and you sell another that you think is expensive, and you're making the little spread, the difference between the two. And so we were just doing that kind of trade because we thought that these things were more correlated than Wall Street thought, and we had never had a view that these things were going to fail, and we never were building anything to fail.
Yeah, and that they were covered. If the housing prices continued to go up, then the stuff they had purchased from the CDO would do very well, and if they went down, then they would also do very well. So it was just playing the spread.
This is, I believe, the first Pulitzer in this category awarded for a piece that never appeared in print. What were some of the advantages or drawbacks to writing online?
I think one of the things that the internet allowed us to do was really be very creative in our storytelling, if you will. We didn't just write a piece, a long story that we threw up online. We did do that, but we also had a comic strip. We had interactive graphs. We had a song that was commissioned by This American Life and a radio program, several radio programs, actually. So the sort of internet gives you the freedom to do that kind of interactive, you know, different kinds of ways of getting the same message and the same story across, which is very liberating.
Now, this is complicated stuff, and you collaborated with NPR's Planet Money team for them, and they did this very memorable piece about the Magnetar deal on This American Life, and then there were other pieces. And these are folks who take complicated stuff and try and become audio storytellers. Did working with them affect the way you reported the story and even the way you reported it in your own text versions?
Yeah, not as much the reporting as the telling. These guys are so great at taking complex topics and really sort of boiling them down and making them not only understandable but enjoyable. And a lot of this stuff, as you said, is very complex and difficult to absorb. And so we learned a tremendous amount from working with them. And I think, at least in the Magnetar story, it was a huge help. Alex Bloomberg, who's the producer on the This American Life piece, really spent a lot of time on the storytelling of it, and it really influenced the way we approached the story as well.
One of the most amazing meetings we had is we sat down with those guys and we walked through all this complicated stuff. Okay, the tranches and the CDOs, and they're buying credit default swaps, and we were, you know, sweating to try to explain this very early on. And Ira Glass says, you know, I think we'd like to turn this into a musical.
And it was so funny. Alex turns to Ira and says, this is the hardest story we've ever done, and you want to layer on top of that a musical, you must be insane. And Ira just would not let it go. And what he had done is he had really sort of boiled it down to this idea that this was very much like the musical The Producers. You know, this they were sort of creating the musical and betting against it. And so we sort of put that aside, but Ira certainly didn't, and he commissioned two of the guys who had been the main guys doing The Producers, and they wrote a song, and it was perfect.
We're talking with Jake Bernstein and Jesse Eisinger. Their series, The Wall Street Money Machine, is the winner of the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guests are reporters Jesse Eisinger and Jake Bernstein of the nonprofit investigative reporting organization ProPublica. Their series, The Wall Street Money Machine, has won the 2010 Prize for National Reporting. We should talk about the second story, which you published in August of last year. And this involved the way, as the mortgage-backed security market wound down, as there were more concerns about risky mortgages and less demand for by investors to buy debts based on these increasingly risky products, that you concluded that the banks kept the market going by creating fake demand. What does that mean? How did they do it?
Well, what happened was investors were leaving the market as early as late 2005, early 2006. Before this, been selling to banks around the world, to insurance companies, but those savvy investors, sophisticated investors, were dropping away, not completely leaving the market, but going away. And so Wall Street replaced that demand with new CDOs. So they would create a CDO, and the CDO would buy pieces of the CDO. Then the new CDO would have pieces that were hard to sell, and so they would create a new CDO, and the CDO would buy pieces of that. And what we found was that the banks were actually orchestrating these sales. They were swapping sales. So they were doing you buy mine and I buy yours type of deals. And they were essentially having this kind of daisy chain of demand that people hadn't really understood before.
Here's what puzzles me about this is if the banks are basically repackaging this stuff and buying these newly minted CDOs from themselves and from each other. I mean, one of the reasons you explain they do that is that the people who put the deals together get fees and bonuses, and they're significant. If they're a tiny piece of a multi-billion dollar deal is a couple million, so there's an incentive. But what I'm wondering is, if they're not really getting new investors and bringing new money in, where do they get the funds to pay the fees and bonuses?
I mean, it's astonishing, but the banking system was so levered. The banking system was running on borrowed money. So when the bank itself kept the top of a CDO, it didn't actually have to put up a lot of money to maintain that asset because it was supposedly AAA and safe as houses, you know, safe as US